Howdy, and welcome to The Stoop. I'm Cutter Gonzalez, your host. Today I'm talking with Carly Booz of the Affordable Housing Alliance of Central Ohio. Carly is someone I admire so much, and I consider it a real privilege to spend time with her. There's just so much to learn. Before we go there, though, here's a little about her and her organization. Carly is the Executive Director of the Affordable Housing Alliance of Central Ohio. In that role, she provides leadership and strategic direction to members, stakeholders, and the local community to expand affordable housing resources. Previously, Carly was Community and Economic Development Counsel at the Legal Aid Society of Columbus, where she oversaw comprehensive legal, logistical, and financial counsel to organizations that make an impact in Columbus neighborhoods. She also has extensive experience in policy and program development from her time serving at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency. At OHFA, she developed the Qualified Allocation Plan, wrote the Ohio and National Housing Trust Fund allocation plans, led issue-specific initiatives for youth housing and assisted living finance, and created the FH Act 50 Building Opportunity Fund. She has also directed housing and economic recovery programming, including the Neighborhood Initiative Program and Save the Dream Ohio. Carly began her career as a consumer rights and housing attorney and also consulted for the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law's faculty on consumer rights issues. She holds bachelor's degrees in women's studies and political science from the Ohio State University and a Juris Doctor from Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Carly is also the president of the board for the Franklinton Development Association. She has authored work for the Journal of Affordable Housing and Community Development Law, What Works from the Federal Reserve Bank, and the American Bar Association. She unwinds at night by baking cakes, listening to her husband play guitar, and making messes with their son, often all at once. The Alliance is a nonprofit that's committed to closing the affordable housing gap in Central Ohio. Its 40 members represent the spectrum of housing experts in the region, including home builders, property owners, housing advocates, housing counselors, shelter and service providers, investors, funders, and the philanthropic community. I won't keep you from her any longer. Let's go. Hi, Carly. Welcome to The Stoop.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So glad. You have so many cool things going on in Columbus that I don't know how we're going to get to talk about them all, but I really hope we do. Before we talk about Columbus, though, let's talk about you. I want to know what your housing story is, like how you got into this space.
Well, that's a long story. When I was in high school and then up into my first couple years of college, I thought I was going to be a ballet dancer. And it was fun, and I love the arts, and I really enjoyed it. But I had kind of a midlife crisis at 18 and jumped out of ballet and into kind of real normal college. And I got a political science and a women's studies degree from the Ohio State University. And I didn't know exactly at that time what I was going to do with that. Like, I think I was just kind of exploring what was fun and what was interesting. And law school felt like the next thing. Like, it felt like if this was a puzzle, that's the piece that has to go in after it. And when I was in law school, it was Ohio, and it was 2007, and the economy just fell out from under us, and it was the housing crisis, and it was terrible. And what I thought I would be doing was civil rights work. So there was, again, the nerdy part of me was like, I'm going to go work for the IRS, and I'm going to use my knowledge of the Internal Revenue Code to put hate groups out of business, because if they're doing bad things, they're probably not paying their taxes.
Yeah.
But it was all housing all the time, and I ended up going to work for a civil rights firm, and that's their whole mandate, was just that we got to stop the bleeding, that housing is the new civil rights front, and that's where we have to be. So as a baby intern, I was picking up, you know, foreclosure defense cases, and I was working with, you know, senior homeowners who were losing everything. And I saw that we could be wildly impactful, and I fell in love with it. So that was the start and end for me. I never looked back.
That is amazing. I think there is a fair amount of arts to housing folks. I myself included, my master's is in orchestra conducting. It's so It's so funny. And like you, I think I went into college wanting to do the arts, and then I got shocked by music school. Music school is atrocious in so many ways. And I switched to geography, which I ended up loving. And then I'd always been interested in cities, but it gave me that academic training to really do it justice. And then ended up going back into the arts, and now here I am again, hosting a podcast on housing advocacy, right? It's amazing. There's something about that creative want to do right by the world fire that arts folks have. I didn't know that about you.
I passionately believe that advocacy should be beautiful. I think there's something that's all about dignity and respect that when you're working with a community that you love, it's got to be gorgeous. And it's so much more powerful when it is too.
Oh, totally. Totally. Beauty is like sorely neglected in our discourse about like everything. And I mean that from like the, I'm a comms person, so the day to day is graphics and writing and whatever else. And so there's a little bit more like proximity to concerns of beauty or some sort of aesthetic in my day to day than when I was doing like just policy stuff. It felt like that was a little bit more like I had to connect it intentionally, which I'm sure you feel. But it's all there. It's all there. And like at the end of the day, all this housing advocacy is a vision of something beautiful, right? Like that's what we're fighting for. I thought what you were saying about even like going to law school and working for the IRS, which like I don't know how many people are like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go work for the IRS. And that's
That's
like,
not normal.
right. It's so beautifully abnormal. And I love that. I love that. But you had like this idea about how to affect that change, and somehow it always ends up housing. It does this to us. That's beautiful. So you're based in Columbus, and tell us about the group you lead and what your whole mission is.
Yeah, the Affordable Housing Alliance of Central Ohio. We're a nonprofit group. Our mission really is to make sure that the region has all of the research and data that it needs, all of the community education. So we can't just kind of own that data. We have to share it profusely, all the technical assistance that it needs, and also a really clarion housing voice to be able to close our housing gaps. And when we talk housing gaps, it's not just one. It's not just kind of a supply challenge. It's not just that we don't have enough housing. Though, as a very quickly growing community, that is a definite part of our landscape. But we also are really concretely focused on home ownership. And we know that that has been historically the pathway to stability and intergenerational wealth. And we want to make sure that those doors aren't just kept open, but that we can expand. And we also really look at housing as a foundation for economic mobility. So, how can we help people move out of poverty? How can creating a stable living space let you get a college education or let you go back to school or just give you the peace of mind to be able to care for your family so that next generation has that hand up? We definitely look at things like zoning reform and we look at how we can support the local infrastructure and have transit-oriented design. But it's civil rights, it's fair housing, it's public policy. It's a really broad spectrum of what we try to see move forward. Oh, I was going to say, I forgot kind of one of the most defining features of AHCO, which is that we are a membership organization. We have 40 members. They are invitation only. You have to be invited to join the alliance. And we are very intentional about making sure that we have experts from every piece of the housing continuum who has a voice in our work. So we definitely have folks who work in, development or property management, but they're all balanced by people who work in the shelter system and deal with, families that are at the most vulnerable space or people who are attorneys and civil rights activists and who see it from that different perspective or philanthropists or CDFIs. And as we're building our objectives, we do it all by consensus. So everybody's got an absolute veto over everybody else. And that's how we know that we are always doing what is best for the community. And never accidentally becoming a trade association. We are always here for the region. And it's awesome.
Yeah, that is markedly different from a lot, I would say most other coalitions, right? Like, even from the get-go, what you were saying about not just supply, I think that's really important because, like, we talk a ton about supply. I mean, that's part of, like, the advocacy fight, right? It's like we've just been so restrictive in housing supply. I'm in Austin. So we had a huge supply issue, right? Like, we grew to a city of 1 million people now. And if you go to central Austin, it still looks like the burbs in some of it, you know? And which means to say, not enough homes where people want them and need them. And that created crises of its own. But the other part of that work, and I think a lot of the harder work these days, is not convincing people that we need more homes, because that seems to be a tide that's turning, thanks to a lot of work, right? But a lot of advocacy. But the other stuff that you're talking about, and the stuff that, like, the people who you are being very intentional about welcoming into Ahako are expert in. I think that's incredible. So how do you find these members to invite?
So it is a little bit rigorous. We have some folks who kind of know our work and see us in the community. We try and be very, very present in all the neighborhoods. So I don't think that we kind of go under the radar. So sometimes folks will approach us. Other times, with 40 members, people will say, "Hey, I've been partnered up with this guy over here and he hasn't been part of the coalition. I think they'd be a great voice." So we kind of take all of those ideas, and we've got a committee that vets new members. And it always starts with a kind of a one-on-one conversation, like, "Let's just talk about who you are and who we are and what a partnership could look like." And I think the biggest question that we end up spending the most of that meeting talking about is, you got to understand that if you join the alliance, I am going to be working all day, every day to put you out of business. And that's weird.
Yeah.
But that's what it is, right? And you're going to have to be aware of that and be down for it. So, like, you are going to have to affirmatively support positions that are against your business interest. You're going to have to support regulation when you don't want regulation. You are going to have to support, funding decisions that might not always cut towards you, but they're good for the community. Yeah, and maybe, some years we might have one or two new members. Some years we might have a little bit more. Some years we might not have any. It just depends.
That is incredible. And I'm really intrigued by this. I also, like, I've worked with you for a little bit now, not like super closely by any means, but like I don't think I knew any of this. And I'm so intrigued. I just want to pick your brain on all of it. Do you feel like that really clear sense of your purpose, your why, is what makes consensus possible in that space with those different voices? Because, like, I talk about the why stuff all the time. You could ask Allison or any of my colleagues, like, but is that the glue that does it? It's just that, like, ferocious alignment on the vision, or what else is it?
I mean, it is definitely that. I think that is the primary feature that makes it possible for us to come to an agreement on anything, is because we are all here to put housing crisis behind us. We are also, just by our nature, very, very data driven. Even kind of at our founders level, the very first thing that we did as an organization is we produced a research report, which found that there were 54,000 residents of Franklin County who were paying more than half their income towards housing. So that most severe cost burden. And as the membership at that time said, "Okay, well, our goal is we're going to cut that in half. And then after that, we're going to keep going. But let's start with half. Let's start with something that feels achievable. And if we can find data-driven, research-backed processes that cut that number, we can support those." And I mean, it's almost academic in the way that people look at it. I think that helps. I will also say, too, though, that we've got the 40 members who are wonderful, but the allies are much, much, much broader. I can't think of any group in all of the region that we wouldn't want to sit down and talk to and figure out what their feedback is and what their recommendations are. And all of that gets baked into the strategic plan.
Yeah, so the allies are like the folks that when you need to go to City Hall, you can call on to also be there and advocate with you, but are not necessarily like the people making decisions about your organization. Is that correct?
Yeah. It could be that. It's definitely that sometimes, right? So it could be folks who are really vocal and, kind of come from an activist space. It also could be groups that don't have housing as their day-to-day,
Sure.
but they serve a population that has a unique housing need. So I'm thinking of, for us, it's AdamH, the alcohol, drug, mental health. They might not do housing 24/7, but they know enough about it to be able to help give us the information. We need to make sure that their interests are reflected in our work. We work really closely with a lot of senior services. We know that older folks, especially older homeowners, as our property tax burden goes up, they might not build housing, they might not rent housing, it might not be part of their work, but they've got valuable information that we got to know to be good at what we do. So yeah, they might not all show up for a public hearing, and that's fine. What we need is their perspective.
Yeah, that's super super interesting and seems super complementary to the internal structure you'll have. And there is something you used to academic and that kind of language, and I think that is important to mark out, especially this day and age, given all that's going on. That part of what makes this feasible is a groundedness and a shared sense of truth and reality. And like being intentionally beholden to the facts, not just vibes. The vibes matter, feelings are data, right? And I think you're obviously reflecting that in the way you go about this and that you have to have consensus and things. But there is that, like, okay, if you're in this room, you agree with these couple things. You know, you're mission aligned. You're saying that the facts matter and we follow the facts even when it doesn't seem like it's in our selfish best interest, you know, but it's better for our community. And I think that's really powerful. So I was kind of clued into the fact that we might think similarly on some of this when I sent guardrails for the podcast guests, which I do every episode. I don't think I've ever said this on the podcast because it's, you know, the how the sausage is made or whatever expression. But I sent those guardrails that we were like super intentional about. I drafted and then went through like multiple iterations of edits, wanted to make sure we got there. And it's all like values language. It's all making sure that our creative practices align with the gift that we want this podcast to be to members of WNN and anyone listening. And you can always tell when somebody is thoughtful like that because they'll write back and they'll be like, oh, I recognize some of these, or I use something similar, or wait, this is what I do, or I like this. There's some comment, and you said something like that when you wrote back, and I was like, I am so excited to have the conversation because it's
I
so
think what I said
interesting.
is I'm going to steal them, and I
Yeah.
stand.
You are more than welcome. None of them are my property. The best values are shared values, and those are all things I like hodgepodge together from working in orchestras. I mean, it seems like it's a far thing from housing advocacy, but like try corralling 100 adult musicians and getting them to believe that your opinion on this 200-year-old symphony is the right one. You know, like, oh my God.
But we're right back to advocacy being art. And another way that I translate that into our work is kind of tackling that the academicization of housing. And there's tons of research that's phenomenal, but it's 90 pages, single spaced,
Oh, yeah.
noted out the wazoo, and it's too dense. And it's got all the answers we need in it, or a lot of them. But you can't reasonably ask, like I'm a mom, you cannot ask me if it wasn't my job to sit down and citate that and note it up.
No.
One of the things that we've done that's been really popular, I think, with some of our partners is that we'll do infographic themes. So we'll do like one was a theme of the intersections between housing and gender and where affordable housing fits into the women's rights conversation. And all we really did was take 20 or 30 different academic research reports, boil it down into the three main takeaways, and add pictures. But it opens that up to folks who never would have had the time to do the 200 hours of reading and research that they would want to.
Yeah, I'm an academic by training and was a doctoral student recently, but put that on pause. So I the like that academic stuff is such a slog, even for academics. Like, I read academic shit day in, day out, and oh my God, when I see that 200-page report, and I'm not a mom or any of that, like, you have so many more constraints on your time and energy. But your voice is so critical in that space. So I absolutely adore that. I think that is so important. And it shows, like, our first meeting together, I think, was like, I left and I messaged Allison. I was like, I feel like I'm totally useless. Carly's just got her shit together, you know,
Said that.
in the
That is the
best
nicest
way.
thing I'll ever hear.
Yeah, no. So, seriously, we all are Carly fans, to be clear. And you, but because your work is just like so grounded, thoughtful, impactful, like start to finish, and that makes a huge difference. And it seemed like real results, right? Like you have done real things in Columbus. And so maybe we should use that as a segue. Let's talk about like what's been going on in Columbus, what have you done, like, and then we can dig into how it happened. And if in case I forget, polling stuff, because there's some exciting stuff there, isn't there, about polling?
Yeah, our newest research project was it was Ahako's first ever community survey.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's the teaser. Let's
Yes, yeah, we'll come back to
I mean, let me set the scene though with kind of where Central Ohio is. And for those who don't know, Columbus has been called Cowtown for as long as anybody's been here. And it's our identity is a little bit, we're a big city, but still a small town. And you know everybody, and you can go into a grocery store and you can bump into the mayor, and that's fantastic. But we have been growing really, really quickly. And that, I think, has been supercharged from some really fantastic economic development wins. So Intel is building a fab here. We have a new group that's going to bring, I think, 500 manufacturing jobs to high-tech defense systems. And all of it's people who are definitely coming here because we're a great place to live. But that's largely a reflection that we are an affordable community, that you can have a killer quality of life. You can start a business, you can start a family, you name it, you can do it here in Central Ohio. And if our housing doesn't keep up with that growth, there is a real concern that we're going to lose one of those defining features. That if we become the next Silicon Valley or the next tech bubble, we don't have a beach to fall back on. Our quality of life is us. So we've looked at housing through a lot of different lenses, and we have had a lot of really significant successes. And we're moving the needle. So I said earlier, we had 54,000 folks who were severely cost burdened. Since we began our work, that's dropped 5%. You name another community that's growing and also reversing the trend. It's not happening. But 5% is still 5%. And just to look at some of the things that we've been able to do together as a community, and this is just Ahako, I think, really as technical advisor, pulling from other cities, pulling from other communities, and saying, here's what they did. How can we make this Columbus or Central Ohio-esque? We've passed $250 million in affordable housing bonds to create long-term, deep affordability. Last year, we passed the first phase of a zoning reform process. Our zoning laws were written in the 1950s, really haven't been touched significantly since. We're working, it's going to be a long haul, but we're working to get that just to meet the moment. We, in December, were able to pass an access to counsel law so that families who are facing an eviction at least have legal advice to know what their rights are and how to protect them. We've passed source of income laws in, I think, 10 different communities. So it used to be legal in Ohio for a landlord to discriminate against something because of how they earned income. As you're growing and as housing availability is shrinking, we saw some landlords who I think within what they felt was their business necessity would say, well, we don't rent to Uber drivers, right? You're not a W-2 wage earner. It's too unpredictable. We're just as a blanket policy, never going to rent to them. Same thing for folks who receive child support, same things for folks who receive any sort of housing assistance. Well, it creates a real fair housing challenge. And now here in Franklin County, 85% of our residents are protected by a statute that prevents that kind of discrimination. So we're moving. We're making really good progress. We also have worked with a coalition called Convergence Columbus that is solely focused on closing the Black and minority homeownership gaps. All of it matters, but the tactics are going to be different based on the history that got us here. And that's one that's done really neat things. And last year, we launched a $5 million down payment program that's geared to the needs of first-generation home buyers. So, in a couple of weeks here, we're hoping to have what, 200, 250 brand new homeowners who are going to be able to turn to their kids and say, I was the first, but I won't be the last. And that's dope.
Yeah, that's real. That's not some data point about how rents have declined X percent or housing stock has increased by 5,000. And those are all important, but that's the moment when you're like, damn,
Right?
the work led to someone literally getting to have that moment with their kids for themselves and for their kids. It's incredible. So how did y'all rise to this moment, and in such a diverse way, and I mean that y'all are doing, it's not just supply. How did that happen?
So I wasn't here at our very beginnings. I've been with the Alliance about 5 years now. But if you ask me, I think the turning point was COVID. I think with any good coalition, we started off with relatively broad ambitions, cut the housing gap in half, but really specific, here's the first steps of how we're going to do that. So it was things like passing what we call the conveyance fee. It's a kind of a very small surcharge that goes on record filings, and then using that fee to be able to construct more affordable housing. And we were, I think, very intent on making sure that we were building out that toolkit one piece at a time and being excellent in every step of it. And then COVID hits, and you feel like you're not doing enough. Like every day you woke up and you're like, oh, I'm putting out one fire and starting 10 more at the same time. So we moved to be much more focused, not just on the financial structure, but also on kind of emergency stabilization. So Columbus, one of the things that Central Ohio just knocked out of the park during COVID was the Emergency Rent Assistance Program. In fact, we did so good. We spent all the money that the federal government gave us, and then they said, can you do more? We got more. If you can do more, just keep doing what you're doing. You guys are the best in the country at it. We're sitting here in a position where it's 2025 and we are still being able to offer emergency rent assistance in a very narrow, very constrained way because those resources are evaporating, but because we were incredibly effective with them.
That is such a critical time to seize upon that COVID, right after COVID. And I'm sure for a lot of the housing work, that is what compelled us. I think here in Austin, similarly, there was a big, we've been growing for a long, long time, but the post-COVID wave and the absolute lack of building at that point, especially in Austin proper, not the surroundings, burbs, it really reached a pain point where you saw a lot of people struggling and then going without homes, right? Like in the severe end. I mean, we have a huge homelessness problem, and it's a failure to respond to the moment before we reached crisis. When you were going about making these things happen, how did you talk to the city or to departments, or what were the who were the decision makers, and how did you reach them to make sure things worked well?
So Franklin County, which is the county that the city of Columbus sits in, is jurisdictionally very, very fractured. It's one of the features of how Ohio is. So I think, and don't hold me to this, but even within Franklin County, there's something like 44 different subdivisions, different city councils, different commissioner bodies, you name it. There's 44 of them. So very fractured. The way I think AHCO looks at this is, look, we're going to be your technical advisor. We're going to tell you where the numbers are. We're going to tell you how housing looks. We're going to tell you how housing's changing. We're going to make sure that you have all of the data and all of the numbers you need to really fundamentally understand your community. We're going to let you know how Columbus or Reynoldsburg or Whitehall or you name that subdivision, how it stacks up to other places in the country. Like, who are your peers? Who do you benchmark against? And then, of those communities, what are they doing that is working? So, really, 99% of our job is research nerd. I very, very rarely put on my advocacy hat because nine times out of 10, when I say, here's what the problem is, here's how others are fixing it, no one needs a push. They don't need to be advocated to. They go, all right, let's find a way to make that feel like us. And then we can be, a technical advisor to say, okay, what issue it is that you're playing with? You're trying to solve homeownership? Let me pull together a focus group of 15 homeowners from your community, and you can talk exactly directly to them about what will work and what won't work. Or let me be able to go to all those other peer cities and pull in five of their executive directors, and they can tell you what they've been through.
Yeah, that's a huge benefit, and it relies on the fact that y'all are trustworthy and have the process you have to where people know that that's like a legit resource, right? Because I think that can be hard to attain for some folks, where like, especially when you're branded like an advocacy org, they're like, oh, they're pushing an agenda, which like, yeah, we all are, obviously. Like, agendas can be good too. But y'all clearly have cultivated a sense of trust in what you're doing that seems, I mean, really earned, like through your process. That seems really, really critical.
And I'm with you. I am transparent that I do come with a bias. Our bias is that every person should have a home that is both safe and affordable.
Yeah, amen.
After that, I don't care. I don't, you tell me what works and let's do that.
I agree. That's the right up front, right? Like, if somebody told me tomorrow that increasing housing supply and had evidence that it was the absolute wrong thing, I would change my mind. You know what I mean? Like,
And gladly, with a smile, right? All right, on to the next one.
right, because the goal is not the policy, it's the things the policy creates or allows to be created in the end. Yeah.
And that's why I don't tend to buy into this NIMBY versus YIMBY dichotomy.
Sure.
Because I don't ever go to a place where someone's like, nope, I'd like to see the community burn. I'm
Right.
taking it all down with me.
Yeah.
Like, we're all out here to try and do what's right. We gotta find a way to collaborate. And I just think most of the time we can.
Yeah. No, and you're not alone in that. I had Graham Downey from Alaska, from Anchorage, Alaska, on this podcast late last year, and Graham said that he didn't believe there were NIMBYs. And I shared that with the network, and with those of us who are in the movement, like, it can be a useful thing to have an opposition that seems like an entity unto itself over there and have a label like NIMBY. But I think what Graham said and what you're saying are jarring to the status quo of advocacy work in a really good way to remind us that these are people who care equally and that they are possible of change, of changing their minds, of coming into the fold, and also us transforming our work in response to them and the things they're seeing. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and I think that takes us back to where we started, which is the survey that we just finished.
Yes. Yeah.
And I will put Central Ohio's data and research chops up against anyone in the country. We punch up when it comes to research capacity. But up until now, it's been really focused on kind of quantifying the problem and understanding change over time. As a region, at least, we haven't gone directly to people and said, okay, y'all agree. We see from all the other numbers that you appreciate that there is a problem here. Now, what do you support to fix it? What are the specific policies that you want to see us adopt as a community? And where's your line in the sand? What goes way too far and you're not ready for it? You don't think we will ever get there? And we found some really fascinating, really powerful things. And I will kind of start by saying, too, we did ask questions in the survey about how vulnerable people feel in this housing market, even though we did have some of that data already. And it's because we wanted to understand if people who feel more at risk, who feel more exposed, have different opinions about policy. And what we found there is that half of all Central Ohio residents, city of Columbus, suburban, rural, you name it, but half of us are personally and negatively affected by the housing shortage. Right?
That's crazy. Also, I want to point out, you said half of us, which I just have to take a sec in the frame of talking about polling and nonsense, we so often say half of them. And just to show the thoroughness with which you're thinking through and practicing this, like that is us. It is so, when you say 50%, I don't know your backstory with housing insecurity, but like I've been through that. I'm finally at a place, luckily, where I'm not. But when I hear that data, I'm like, oh my God. It's so real. It's so real. So sorry to interrupt your flow there, but I just wanted to like, that is so important.
No, it is. And the next data point I think is just as important, which is that almost three quarters of us have a loved one who is feeling this problem. And I am very fortunate that as of today, my home is safe and secure, and I am not feeling it personally. But I can rattle off a list of friends, absolutely, who are either struggling to pay rent or have been fighting to buy a home for years and just can't find one, or even older family members who are seeing taxes go up and up and up, and they legitimately don't know what they're going to do. There is a break point and they see it coming and they don't know what happens after that.
Right. That's like also critically under talked about. It's like there seems to be, when you're in the policy world, like sometimes there's just this assumption that people will make do. Like there will always be some solution that arises. And maybe that is some kind of like hope in a fictional like neoliberal utopian thing that is actually not real. But like there are real moments for so many people that your data is showing. Here that like they don't know what happens past that point. Like if something bad happens, there's not a solution currently for a lot of them. And like you said, like I can name people in my close circle that are like that. And what's next for them?
Those were the first two data points that I personally got to see after the survey. That was kind of in the way that the numbers were produced. Those were the first two ones. And I knew that every other question we asked after that, I knew that it was going to be pro-housing. You can't have that much vulnerability and that much insecurity and not have an overwhelming wave of people saying, do something about it. So we did ask a lot of questions. This particular survey was really focused on land use. Because it's a place to start. I would love to do this survey and recreate it for every policy avenue we've got, but we started there. And it's 80 plus percent of people, or around 80% of folks, who want more missing middle housing. They want more ability to build an accessory dwelling unit. They want the jobs and the homes just to be closer together. I think one of the things that we've got here is a geospatial challenge, and that you can easily have a 45-minute commute. And I think that's really tiring. Overall, I think that the feedback grouped into two categories and they overlap, but it was affordability, and people don't feel like they have control over their housing budget anymore. You can't upsize, you can't downsize, you just get what you're given, and that feels very disempowering. And I think a really related thing that we heard in the survey is that regardless of price, I'm tired of being told what I'm allowed to have and what I'm not allowed to have. I might be willing to pay $1 billion for an accessory dwelling unit, but even with my $1 billion, you're telling me I cannot have it. And I think that's a friction that's really coming to the surface. And I think it's even harder when people say, well, these are tools that my grandma and grandpa used. These are housing styles that let them give me opportunities, but now I can't give those opportunities to my kids. And it's just this conflict between laws that weren't built for today and people button up against them.
Yeah, and laws that were built to ensure the what we now come to understand as vibrancy and diversity and strength of our communities to make sure those things didn't happen because certain people might be there, right? So much of this is undoing a lot of really nasty things in the mid 20th century, during that nadir of race relations especially. But yeah, it's incredible. And I mean, you're talking 80% some plus on some of these, right? Like, that's nobody nobody gets that. Like, if you could ask a politician, like, what they would hope for in a survey like that, you're like, if you're breaking 50, you're good, and if you're breaking 60, oh my God, you know. But you're getting like overwhelming support. And does that, do you see that effect on folks when you share that data and say, like, look, people want this, that they're like, oh, I feel more comfortable advocating for that now? Does that translate?
So I think you were asking kind of what's the response been like? How have people, I think on one hand, people are unsurprised, especially when you're talking to folks who have been struggling for so long. Some of this felt intuitive, and almost at times I think people were like, why do you even need to ask? Like, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Overwhelmingly, no pun intended, because the name of the report is overwhelming, but overwhelmingly, people said, yeah, that feels right. Now, I will say that there has been a very small kind of bubble of conversation, almost exclusively on the internet, who has said, I'm not in your survey. I don't see myself in here. And my initial reaction is, first, let's sit down and talk about that, right? Let's unpack it, because maybe you do have feedback that I need to know. But I think my next instinct is, yes, you are in here. You're just surprised to find out that you're in the 5% and not the 95%. And it is jarring when your entire echo chamber has been saying, you're the majority, you're the overwhelming response. To find out that you're not is hard. I know from the research itself that those who are kind of grouped into what we would call the NIMBY sentiment, but for us, that was people who expressed not just opposition to these policies, but strong opposition. The best indicator of whether somebody would fall into that category is how they answered, do you have a loved one who's hurt? And people who are not affected themselves and do not have a loved one who is affected were much, much, much more likely to be opposed to policy change. And that makes sense to me. If you don't think this is real and you don't feel that pressure, then of course you're not going to feel the need for anything to change.
God, that is so crazy to see borne out like that in the data. And so important, because it's like there's all kinds of old, kind of folk wisdom about perception as reality and all these, things that hint at this idea that, like, the way we construct the world around us for us, for our day-to-day use, is informed by the world we have accessible to us. And if people can't understand that there are others in the world who aren't as fortunate or aren't as secure, then they're not going to feel that impetus to the kind of burning, like, we need to do something, right? And yeah, it's got to be just, it's hard to find out you're not in the majority. I'm sure we all have experiences like that. Maybe not on housing, but in various things where we were like, oh, I am not as in the popular mind as I thought I was.
Well, and if I can go further too, and I've been thinking a lot, because this is what we've been talking about all week. It's very new, it's very fresh. So I've been internalizing a lot of this conversation, trying to make sense of it myself. But part of what my job is right now is to protect the NIMBYs. They are the last folks who are unaffected by this. And as much as they are in some ways working against the things that we are trying to do, we have to protect them because we can't let any more people get affected by this. We cannot wait until it touches every one of us before we act. We've got to be more preemptive than that.
Yeah, that is how far-reaching it has to be. That's going to be the social media caption for this post, is protect the NIMBYs.
Hashtag save the
Yeah. Something I never thought would be said on this podcast, but
NIMBYs.
here we are.
I like
Well,
to break the mold. I will say though, and again, I don't, I me personally, I don't use the phrase NIMBY very much.
yeah.
Because I do think that almost everyone I have talked to has been doing it for what they think is the right purpose. And oftentimes I agree. So, one of the common things that we hear from folks who say, well, you can't build housing or you can't build that here, we can't do that, is they'll say something like, because I live in this neighborhood and we don't have a grocery store. And how could we possibly build more homes when the people who move there won't have fresh food? That's a totally valid piece of information, right? That perspective has all the merit in the world. But by getting into the why, we can now troubleshoot and find those win-wins, right? So, like, the reason we don't have a grocery store here is that all of those grocers have come in and they've done market study analysis and they don't see enough rooftops. They are afraid that if they open a grocery store, they're going to go bankrupt. We build more homes, we give them more customers, and we work with our public policy and our public-private partnerships. We can hit both of these things at the same time. I just think instead of dismissing it as, oh, well, that's uninformed or that's not in our best interest, if we can sit down and talk about these things, most of the time we're going to come out with something that everybody's happy with.
I think there's a difference of perspective and in the approach at its foundation in what like you're offering versus sometimes what we see is kind of technocratic or abstracted or academic entrees into housing. It does feel different. I'm sure you felt this because you've been around other folks in the movement and not to dismiss anyone's work, because it's all very important as part of this ecosystem kind of ideas and actions. But those who are so rooted in place, like you obviously are, like you care immensely about Columbus and Central Ohio, and it comes across, and you're like, I mean, like me, I jokingly said at some point that I'm gonna like my job outside of my day job is to be an Austin propagandist, because I was like, I love this place, and I think evidently you do too about your home. And when you come at it from that, your neighbors are not an abstraction or a failure to understand a technical research paper or some kind of ignoramus or something, you know, like they're a real person with real concerns and real needs that you can actually contact. There's like not a shame element, I guess. And that you mentioned the why, and like that's that why, that rootedness is where identity is, right? And so if you can agree on that, there's so much more room for to be creative and to generate ideas and make connection. And it de-escalates like the parts that other and make fear get in the way of all the good work. And the kind of the another type of activist is the type that's really just bought in from like, and I get this as an academic person. I mean, you're obviously a very smart, intellectual person too, so I'm sure you understand that like sometimes you can read a paper and you're like, you get fired up about it from the data, but like if then you risk not touching grass and not realizing that those are real people. It's so refreshing to have you say this, and so important. I think I've been kind of in a slog right now. I'm going to be out the rest of the week, and so hearing you talk about this, I'm like, oh yeah, this is why we do it. This is the why. This is it. And challenging the day-to-day work to be more human, and to touch real people, you know, that's critical.
And I would jump in too, and I like that you use the word human because I think another defining feature of the Alliance itself is that we are strongly rooted in human-centered design, that we should co-design with people instead of top-down prescribed to people. So that's going to look different for every initiative that we're part of, but I think of one quite a bit. We help operate a website called Redful 614, and it's the county's one-stop eviction prevention resource hub. And like we've got 40 eviction and housing experts on our team. We absolutely could have just put together a website and it would have been technically accurate. But instead, what we did is we went down to the courthouse with $20 bills and we just said, anybody who will stop before you head into eviction court on your way out of eviction court and tell us what you think, just give me 3 minutes of your time and I got $20 for you. And it completely changed how we thought of that website. Our instinct going in was red, white, and blue. Uncle Sam, make it look government official. That's what people trust. And the very first piece of feedback we heard is the only thing we trust less than people is the government. So it's just it. I think that you can have all those good intentions, but unless you're rooted and anchored, on the ground, in the grass, you're gonna lose stuff.
That's such an interesting approach to that. And I love hearing that, like, fundamentally transformed that, 'cause yeah, we make these assumptions a lot, like, as you know, professionals who have to do the work of housing advocacy, whatever that means. We think we know. And then you go and you talk to someone actually who's just, I love that it was like who just faced it too. Oh my gosh. As like a qualitative researcher, I'm like, yes, that is golden.
And I want to say too, I don't want to be flippant about that experience and how traumatic of a day that those folks were having. The only
Yes.
reason we felt comfortable going down and being in that environment is because there was an entire resource desk set up, that there were free attorneys on site, there was emergency rent assistance on site, there were housing counselors, there were mediation. If those folks had been out there alone, I would never have presumed to walk into that space and inject myself into their day. It was only because they had the safety that we felt welcomed.
Yeah, I was gonna ask about that, 'cause yeah, I mean, obviously, like, as exciting as that data is to get as a researcher, like to go back to you're dealing with real humans who are dealing with something that is fundamentally traumatic in ways that people who have not faced that cannot grasp, and having that like whole array of service present is so important. And I think thematically throughout the conversation, like that's what I love, and I want to bring to the work I do as a private citizen activist in Austin too, besides my day job with the Welcoming Neighbors Network, but also there, is like make that menu more a part of the conversation. Here, for obvious reasons, in Austin, we've been so laser focused on supply, and there's been a lot of good stuff like we've tried to do on affordable housing in a variety of forms. We're kind of hampered by a state house that doesn't care to do anything for renters these days. But I'm like, there's more we can do. And this is inspiring me to be like, I want to center that in the work, not allow that to be at the fringes anymore. Like that needs to be the root of it. So that's I'm gonna think about that a lot.
I mean, we're fortunate in Ohio, and there always is more work to do. I'll preface it with that. We've not cracked the code entirely, but the cities understand they're the front lines. They know that there's challenges. They know they need to solve them. But I have, I think, just as much faith in our state house and our administrative agencies at the state level. We're all still trying to figure out exactly what the right toolkit is and how to pull it together. But I've never met with someone who completely dismisses the challenge and says, "Ah, oh, no, y'all are fine.
Yeah.
It's just growing pains. We'll get through it." I think everybody is really serious and really committed, and it helps, I think, if nothing else, with the motivation. Like, I don't think that many of our team wake up and feel demoralized during the day. We're all ready to go.
I love that. Well, somehow we are already coming up on the hour. We could talk for hours about this, and hopefully we will at some point and or at multiple points. But before we wrap, is there anything you feel compelled to share? It could be about the work, it could be about how we do it, it could be about the policies, it could be weed seed, whatever you want. I just want to open the floor.
Well, we do have a newer initiative that we just launched this year that I'm really stoked for. It's called The Platform, and it is a leadership cohort. So, for folks who are very passionate about housing advocacy, we've got this small group. It's 10 housing advocates who are going through this year-long training program. And we don't control or influence their message at all. They might advocate for something that we are completely opposed to, but it's in the housing lane. And what we're able to do is to teach them transferable skills. So, how do you write an op-ed, right? You've got your op-ed. How do you contact an editor to know how to get it in the newspaper? What makes good public testimony? How do you use Canva for advocacy? So, we just do the skills. And then they have that power to go out into the community and use them. And back to that kind of how do we work with policymakers? I have been so proud and so impressed that most of our teachers are elected officials. So our housing chair was the one who came in and taught how to give public official testimony.
Wow.
Like, who's better to tell you what good testimony is than the lady who's listening to it?
Yeah.
And next month we've got it's the meeting on how to host power meetings. So you've got your shot. You've got 10 minutes with a legislator behind a closed door. How do you make the most of it? And we've got a state senator who's coming in to teach it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible. And you rest assured, I'm going to be emailing you after this about that because I am so interested. Yeah. I want to hear more about this after it has been through too. So maybe we'll have you back on the podcast again and we can dig in. Well, Carly, just so immensely grateful to share space, virtual space with you today, and for sharing your immense wisdom with all of us in the network. We're all better because of it. So thank you so much.
You're really, really too kind. I get to be a small part of a big movement and I love it. And I love being able to listen to you talk to leaders and share all of this with each other. So thank you.
Carly is a powerhouse. Her coalition has achieved incredible things, and they're not resting on their laurels. With public opinion firmly on their side, it's going to be so exciting to see what they do next. You can find the Affordable Housing Alliance of Central Ohio on social media. They are at AHACO housing.bsky.social on Blue Sky, at Affordable Housing Alliance 614 on YouTube, and on Facebook at facebook.com/AHACO housing, and as well on LinkedIn, where you can just search their name, of course. You can also go to their website, ahaco.org. They're all over the place. As always, you can connect with the Welcoming Neighbors Network online at welcomingneighbors.us and on social media. We are at WNN Pro Housing on Instagram and at welcomingneighbors.us on Blue Sky. The Stoop is produced in-house at the Welcoming Neighbors Network by me, Cutter Gonzalez. The music for our show was created by my friend Nolan Hopkins. If you have ideas for our show, including special episodes, guests you'd like to hear from, or topics you'd like to cover, shoot me an email at cutter@welcomingneighbors.us or DM me on social media. My handle is at Cutter W. Gonzalez across all platforms. Thanks for joining us, and talk to y'all real soon.